VentureCast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So I'm just sitting there with my daughters and I'm like just all choked up. I'm actually crying and they're like, oh, it's so, and first of all, it's just lovely to have daughters. They're so nice. It's so nice to me. They're like, oh, it's so, like, look at this. So cute. Dad's crying. What is it? And just from the deep recesses of my mind, for no reason at all, I just say, home, it's where you wanna be, but I guess I'm already there. And it just broke me. Like, I'm just sobbing because the book is about this story and that song somehow so perfectly captures this moment where it's like the place you live with the people you love is your home, but it takes a while for you to recognize that.
50 years of music with 50-year-old white guys.
Today, welcome to 1984. Jeff Simons, you look like you're outside in sunny Berkeley, California.
Sitting in my glorious driveway on a glorious Sunday, late morning, early afternoon. I'm not out here just because I'm a nature lover. I have just cleaned out my garage and I am guarding a giant pile of trash until I get it into the.
You actually think people will come along and start picking through your.
People have already walked by and looked up the driveway in gleeful anticipation of me leaving so they could start going through it. Yeah.
Okay. Well, there you go. Ben Barton, how is Knoxville, Tennessee today?
Today is a beautiful, gorgeous day. The Vols won again yesterday, but I'm sad to report.
Uh-oh.
I spent the entire weekend writing these memos that I do for midterms. So it's been a miserable, miserable weekend for me. That's where I'm at.
So
that's my headspace coming in.
You gave a midterm exam. And now you have to process that for the students.
Yeah, in between then and now, I did, like, in defense of why I'm behind, I did go visit Jeff. So that was super
fun. Right.
Okay. But then I'm on the Dean Search Committee, and we did 19 45-minute Zoom interviews in 2 days.
Oh, my God.
It was just like being beaten with a stick.
I can't even believe that's a factual
statement. I finished that up
statement.
And then I had to do all the grading. So I'm at my wit's end.
19.
Sure.
We get it down to 10 before the Zoom interviews?
The good news is we had a lot of good applicants. The bad news is we did 19 interviews in 2 days. And I was got pretty punchy by the end, as you can imagine.
I bet.
Oh man, yeah. Were you just cracking jokes by guy number 17?
Oh dude, it's a much longer story about what happened to poor guy number 18. But it was a 45-minute interview. He blew through all the questions. He's basically leaving 5 minutes to the end. And my part is to say, if you have any questions, tell us now. He blows through all the questions in 25 minutes. So then there's another 20 minutes left in the interview. So I'm like, you have any questions for us? And out of nowhere, he asks an amazing question. Here's his question.
Good.
Are you ready? He's like, I want to learn about your decision-making process. And I want to learn about the nature of the faculty. Tell me how you all make decisions. Tell me a story of when it worked well and a story of when it didn't work well. I was like, that's a deep, insightful question.
That's good stuff.
And I was like, we've got 20 minutes. And there was a long pause. I let my colleagues have a shot at it. So then I just launched into a 15-minute broadside on a time where it didn't work out and I was still mad about it. It was well done by me.
Oh my God.
Wow.
It's so fantastic.
You hit right up to the mark. That is terrific. Ah, wow. Well, it's beautiful in Asheville, North Carolina. Look.
Oh, Timmy, still in the basement.
Yeah.
Still in the dank Asheville basement.
The dank.
You have
Asheville.
Gotten out this morning, though. Tim and I talked earlier this morning when he was taking one of the many Hughes plane progeny to Driver's Ed.
Driver's Ed today.
Rock on. Fun city.
Ben, you'll love the driver instructor told Patrick to just go ahead and get on the highway, and they drove to Tennessee.
Nice.
His second time in a car. He's on the highway.
Dude, that stretch of 40 is a little bit scary.
It's a little scary. He had trucks passing him.
Did he blast Rocky Top at full volume on the radio at the same time?
He did. All right, but let's get going. We've got a beautiful Sunday afternoon here, but we have to get our minds wrapped around 1984 when I was starting high school and you guys were sophomores, right?
Yep, sophomore year, 84, 85. End of freshman year, beginning of sophomore year.
Well, we already know what the best-selling album is of 1984. It is, of course, Thriller by Michael Jackson. You know what? I'm sorry. We start with the Grammy winner. Jeff Simons, Off the Top Rope, with one of the most passionate love songs I remember from my youth.
It's the Grammy winner.
Can't Slow Down by Lionel Richie.
And this hurts my feelings.
I've been alone with you inside my mind.
Super creepy.
And in my dreams, I've kissed your lips a thousand times.
The noise? That made me so happy. A caterpillar arrived? What is going on? Pass outside
my door. Here it comes. Hang in there.
Hello. Is it me you're looking for?
Oh, dear. Okay.
I can see it in your eyes.
Wow.
Don't worry. There's only 4 minutes and 58 seconds left of that song.
Is it that long?
Yeah, it's a long one.
Can't slow down with a song like that. Because if you got any slower, you'd be dead.
Yeah, misnamed record. Oh, I can slow down a plenty.
This to me is really, it's like exhibit 1A of the production sound of this time. As an Adele-like piano ballad, this song's okay. It's not great, but it's fine. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like,
yeah.
But it's the production just makes it so hideous. I mean,
you're out on the
cheesy keyboard side, and then the weird noises that come along with it are just brutal. Brutal.
Fits with the very artsy video.
Yeah. Worst video ever made. Worst. What is his name? Henry Brown, the guy who wrote for Grantland and for
Rembert. Yeah.
Rembert Brown. Yeah. Has written the definitive essay on this video, but it was already exhibit A for toxic masculinity and everything you can do wrong as a male authority figure. I mean, it's just so unacceptable.
Lionel Richie's the teacher. Is he?
No, he's the teacher and she's the student and she's blind and she makes a bust of his face out of clay from feeling his face. The best point though is like he's silently watching her like sculpt his face into clay, and when he gets to hello, he grabs her hands and screams hello, and she doesn't do what she would do in real life, which is flinch and go Jesus Christ. That made me laugh when I was 12 watching the video.
It's a bad look. It really is.
First of all, Jeff, it's obvious that she smelled him coming. You know what I mean? She knew where he was.
Her other senses are very heightened.
All right. Welcome to 50 Years of Music with 50-Year-Old White Guys, part of the Drive-In Podcast Network. So go to musiccitydrivein.com for all your podcasting needs. Guys, there's a new podcast in the family. In the Drive-In Podcast family.
Yeah, I heard. What do you know? What can you tell us? I saw that announcement.
It's the only professional wrestling podcast I know of. I'm sure there are others, but now we got one in the stable.
That is great.
So I'm sure they're going to do a special on Jimmy Superfly Snuka.
Well, our boy Ricky would know. You know, he would be the expert I would trust. The former wrestler himself. He's going to know who to pick for that podcast. That's awesome.
Right. All right. Let's move on to 1984 proper. So what do you think of this Big Brother government, huh?
That was a great joke. I really like that. That took a second for me.
Go Oceania.
Sorry, wrong. I got my notes jumbled here.
How much does it bum you guys out that 1984 and Animal Farm are now like poisonous texts that you can't discuss in politics because everyone claims them for their own, and it's like a symptom of what's destroyed. It's just breaks my heart.
They both claim them.
We know
everybody claims them, and in really bad, sad ways. It just doesn't work out for me at all.
You know what's interesting about though? I read this. I don't remember who wrote it. Somebody in the New Yorker wrote. I think it was maybe in 2004. They were writing about, you know, every 04, they bring 1984 up and like, are we there yet? But he wrote this fantastic piece that, and you guys probably already put this together, but Orwell's big blind spot is he thought capitalism had no chance. Like he didn't pay any attention to America. He didn't pay any attention to capitalism as a potential organizing principle for society. He was like, well, that'll last like a year. It's either totalitarianism or, you know, I mean, and when I reread 1984 through that lens of giving capitalism no stake or no thought, it's really problematic. Like it's hilarious as you get to some of these moments, you're like, well, you know what? A free market really would have prevented that. And so I'm less sad that 1984 has become antiquated. I do think Animal Farm is a remarkable little novella, you know. And I'm sad that you can't really teach that anymore, but.
I teach it, but it's called Charlotte's Web. It's All right.
Oh my God. Yeah, no, my version is called Shaun the Sheep. Every time I watch Shaun the Sheep with my daughters, I imagine a moment where they like put him in a van and take him to the glue factory and everything goes really dark, really fast, you know?
That would be awesome. So in 1984, the best picture is what wins the Oscar for best picture?
Is this the Reds year?
It is not.
It's earlier than that. Is it the Last Emperor's year?
It is Terms of Endearment.
Okay. Good one.
I don't know if you guys are going to get this right away. It took me a second. Who was the host of the Oscars in 1984?
I have no idea. Like zero idea.
Ben?
I mean, is it still like in the Bob Hope era, or where are we?
Johnny Carson, who was an excellent host of the Oscars. The TED Conference is founded, Ideas Worth Spreading, all the way back in 1984, which I did not know.
Right?
The first TED Talk. If you could give a TED Talk, like legitimately, don't be funny, but in your heart of hearts, if you could get out there and give a TED Talk, what would you go with? What would be your TED Talk?
This is my TED Talk. This is my weekly TED Talk. This is probably the only information I have of value.
Take what I said about REM and just boom, there you go.
I have got a really, really tight, well-constructed 12 minutes on my bowels. And I think that's what I would focus on. I've done a longitudinal study and I've got a lot of wisdom to share.
How about you, Tim?
And you said bowels, did you?
Yeah.
Bowels. Well, now I don't have a funny answer. I was going to go serious.
You can go serious, brother.
Thank you. I'd like to do a TED Talk talking about Mark Twain's construction of Adventures of Huckleberry Finn along with Winslow Homer's painting career. Bring those two things together. Right? Because then you got art images, so it's not just people looking at me. They don't want that.
I like it.
All right. All right. I will tweet at the TED people and see what they think. They'll be like, bowels? Whoa, say more.
Ben has slides and video for that, too. It's just of a totally different nature.
So... The video game Tetris debuts in 1984. Have any of you spent any time playing Tetris?
Oh, there was a Tetris game, like the video game Tetris was in the basement lounge at Haverford. And there was always like a free night every couple of months where they turned all the machines to free.
Wow.
And I definitely tore the Tetris. I mean, I'm not good. Like as soon as it got even remotely fast, it was like boink, 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 done. But
it ends quickly.
I imagine Ben was probably pretty good at it.
No, no, no. India Kincannon is the Tetris champ for sure. Yeah, whatever the Tetris that came free with the computer on, there was like a 9-month period where she went into a little bit of a sinkhole there. And that kind of had to be dragged out.
But that's great, because when you think about public policy and how all
it's all just fitting it together, Timmy.
You got, yeah. I used to play it at my brother-in-law's house, but I knew it was becoming addictive. So I'd be like, okay, I'll just play one more song and then I'll stop. And I would always choose Traffic's The Low Spark of High Heeled Boys.
12 minutes. Awesome. Really. Did you guys ever play Klax, the like three-dimensional Tetris, where they come flipping down and you have to put them into columns at the bottom?
Oh,
that game
terrible.
Broke my brain. I was so bad at it.
Yeah, that sounds rough.
KLAX, I think it was called.
They
They had it at Haverford.
We usually at this point go to the best-selling album of the year, but we already know that is Thriller. However, I'm really interested in what Ben's going to say about this. For the albums that were actually released in 84, debuted in 1984, what is the greatest selling album that comes out of that particular year?
I was really firm on my pick this year, so I didn't need to do any research at all. I just can't. I have no clue.
Okay.
I mean, did Hamlin's 1984 come out this year? It's not that.
Yeah, it's not that.
I'll
give it. The hint is it's a compilation record.
Is it a soundtrack? Just tell me.
Not a soundtrack. Well, it's the greatest hits.
It's not Born in the USA by Bruce. It's not Purple Rain by Prince. It's not Madonna. Which Madonna came out, Jeff?
Like a Virgin. Nile Rodgers' ascendance to greatness.
Nor is it
last week.
Footloose, which is one of the greatest soundtracks of all time.
It's the greatest sell. It's the second greatest selling greatest hits record of all time. Behind the Eagles.
Is it? Wow. All right, just give him some notes, Jeff.
It's a record where you know every song to the point where you never want to hear any of the songs again, even though they're outstanding. And it's the one of the two.
I said
cassettes.
Give him notes, like play a song.
It's also one of the two cassettes everyone came to college with that they bought in high school because they were supposed to.
That's actually true. Yeah.
Is it Legend?
Yeah.
It is Legend. That is correct. Very good.
That's the second best-selling greatest hits record of all time. That is freaking insane.
There are moments when it's one of the all-time. I mean, it's in the top three of all time. It sells worldwide. It's gonna eventually
going.
Be number one. Like
it's selling
at a rate that's astonishing compared to all of its competitors. So within a matter of like 5 years, it'll be the best-selling record in the history of planet Earth.
Now this is gonna be awkward. Was that actually your pick for this year, Ben?
Yeah, nice try.
All right. Also in 1984, Jeopardy begins. Who was the original host of the Jeopardy game show? It was Alex Trebek. I don't know why.
What are you doing?
That was great, Timmy. Thank you.
Sorry. That's just mean.
Alex Trebek?
Vanessa Williams resigns. As Miss America.
Boy, that's hard to imagine that scandal was enough to lose Miss America. What would you have to do now to lose your Miss America crown? Like, what video footage would they have to have?
Have to do more than that, right?
Oh, yes. Yes,
because,
you would.
Because what she did was nothing that Melania Trump didn't do, and she became First Lady.
Indeed.
Uncalled for, Timmy. That was a shot across the bow of our good Slovenian friend Melania.
It's true.
It's true.
That was it.
Artsy nudes. That's, you know, a little risque at times.
Artsy nudes.
It's actually the title of my autobiography. No.
That should be your TED Talk.
Yeah, for sure.
So, Tim Plaine's world of artsy nudes.
So Ben Barton, Nina, our Twitter follow.
Yeah.
She is just awesome. She's well behind in the podcast listening. But
she's gonna catch up and she wants to guest. So get ready. Strap in, boys. We're gonna have some Nina on here.
I'm a little nervous about this because
she's the spicy one.
She's begun giving me topics to slip in, and they're good. Which really makes me sad. So it's like topic for the host to slip in. When, why, and how do covers exceed the original? And like all of her suggestions that she keeps coming up with overshadow, you know, my 1984 joke. So I'm a little
well, what is Hog Timmy? Are you worried that you're going to be replaced?
I am.
Are we
going to
boot
worried.
You and it's going to be Nina?
Off the top of your head, what's a cover that does the original? Go.
Janis Joplin.
Which Janis Joplin?
Me and Bobby McGee.
Me and Bobby McGee better than Kris Kristofferson? Ben?
Yes.
That is hard. Let me think for a second.
Aretha Franklin, Respect.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
And then All Along the Watchtower, Hendrix over the Hill.
That's a great one.
Yeah,
I have one that you guys should just disagree with, so that'll make you happy.
Hit it.
I prefer the Stones' Ain't Too Proud to Beg. The
1974
Stones cover of Ain't Too Proud to Beg. Huh. I just freaking love that version of it. So good.
Interesting. I don't know if I can say that.
No, I know. That was a spicy one.
Original that, sorry, a cover that woefully failed.
This is not one that woefully failed, but I was thinking about this because of the Stevie Ray Vaughan stuff from last week. So Stevie Ray Vaughan does a cover of Superstitious.
Oh, yeah.
It's a pretty good cover. It's not terrible. Jeff, have you seen the video of Stevie Ray Vaughan and Stevie Wonder and the members of Salt and Peppa and one other random woman Superstitious?
Wow. No, I have not.
You won't believe it. I've got to recommend it. It's amazing. So it starts out and Stevie's doing the keyboard part on the guitar and you're like, this could be good. And then Stevie starts singing and you're like, well, this is weird. Why would you let Stevie Ray Vaughan sing when Stevie Wonder is next to him? But that strikes me as bad management. But you're like, okay, whatever. Then Stevie Wonder takes a turn and you're like, okay, this is fine. It's a really, really, really bad, poppy, cheesy version of it. And then they start letting the Salt and Pepper people and other people take verses. You're like, what is going on? And then every once in a while they'll pan back out and Stevie Ray Vaughan is like, I don't even know what's happening. I have no idea why I'm here. Is there a bag of money somewhere? What am I doing here?
How did this happen? I don't remember the name of the band. Does anybody remember the name of the horrible 90s new metal band that covered Smooth Criminal by Michael Jackson?
Oh, Ant Farm.
Alien Ant Farm. Alien Ant Farm. Think that's I really thought that's
good for them for covering it.
I disagree. I like that.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I'm happy for them.
I thought that sucked.
All right. Well, let's get on to our three albums.
Our three albums.
Jeff Simons, you go first.
All right. I am going with my weirdest pick to date.
Indie King Cannon, put on the seatbelt, babe.
Dude, everybody, play Tetris. Especially Ben. So
when you finally chose an REM record, but you chose the first REM record, Indie was like, what was he doing? And why did you choose that song? She said, why didn't you choose one of the later records with good songs? And I was like, oh, well, that record's okay. It's got Ready for Europe on it. She's like, wait, that was on that record? And you chose that Catapult song?
I was on purpose.
I'm just saying. You continue to hurt Indie Kid Cannon's feelings.
Well, this is going to crush everybody's feelings.
Oh, no.
But this is good. This is actually, I think, the most underrated record of the 80s. I'm going to go out on a limb and say, I think this record is better than anybody except the very small weird group of us who have found each other on the internet. It's actually one of those records when I meet other musicians who I respect, I try to slip it into conversation and they almost always go, oh my God, right? For example, I brought this record up on Twitter about 6 months ago and our wonderful guest, Michael Jorgensen from Wilco immediately tweeted me back like, love that record, couldn't agree more. So,
wow, huh.
Having said that, Ben's literally going to split in half and start melting when I make the case for this record. It's going to be great. So Ben has already made it clear that 80s keyboards are the worst. And he's not wrong. He's not wrong. They sound so antiquated. That Yamaha DX7 sound
is
just awful.
I know who it is.
Yeah, you know who it is.
I do.
I think I'm getting a glimmer too.
And this guy is probably the king of the 80s keyboard in the sense that his work as a session musician before he even starts a solo career starts the whole thing. He's the keyboard player on Foreigner 4. He's the guy who programmed all the sounds on Urgent and all those things. His one song that everybody knows is a classic one-hit wonder. In fact, it might be the classic one-hit wonder. Like bigger than, better than 99 Red Balloons. I mean, like, there's a lot of great one-hit wonders from there. Better than Always Something There to Remind Me or Kaja Goo Goo's Too Shy. Like,
I connected to Safety Dance. Like, that's another one-hit wonder.
Also fabulous. Anyway, the guy's name is Thomas Dolby, and everybody knows him for She Blinded Me with Science from 1983.
She Blinded Me.
It's a funny video. It's a funny song. It's silly. It's ridiculous. The interesting thing is that if you actually bother to buy the record that She Blinded Me with Science is on, which of course I did, it's called The Golden Age of Wireless, and there's actually three or four sneakily great songs on it. Like, really well-written songs, really well-sung, really thoughtful lyrics. I will say it is a, it's an example of a guy who really understands how to program a Fairlight synthesizer using all the stuff. We just listened to Hello, and there's that little caterpillar, right? This was the moment where everybody was playing with that toy and trying to come up with weird sounds. Dolby has this one hit, you know, he goes top five, and he can do anything he wants with the second record, right? The record company's like, great, hey, let's have She Blinded Me with Science 2. Let's ride this gravy train until you're done. But the thing about Thomas Dolby is he's actually a really excellent musician. He's a classically trained piano player. He's a genius engineer. Like, he actually understands all this material. And now he's got a big bag of money from the record company. And the thing I love about his second record, which is what I'm going to choose as the best record of 1984, is rather than chase, you know, a big hit record, he makes the one record he knows he's going to get to make and probably never get to make again. He takes all of the short-term capital he has with Capitol Records, with his audience, and he makes a cinematic, fascinating, super challenging record called The Flat Earth. Everybody I know who listens to The Flat Earth three or four times loves it. But I understand why most people haven't, right? The first side is three songs. They're each 6 minutes long. They have these big, long intros and outros. There's zero attempt here to write a hit single, but they are all beautiful songs. I'm going to choose the title track to play a minute from. And it's an incredible example of Dolby using all of this stuff, not as toys, but as interesting backdrops for a absolutely beautifully made record. The Flat Earth, the first three songs, they're all songs about disengagement, right? They're about, the first song, Dissidence, is about being, you know, having to go underground to have your point of view. The second song, The Flat Earth, is about feeling disconnected from society in general and not knowing what to do with this, the kind of sense of feeling obsolete in a modern world. Screen Kiss is an old Hollywood murder story set in the Hollywood Hills. Like, these songs are intentionally meant to be lost in. And Dolby, because he's a great piano player and because he has great taste in other instruments, like, the guitar parts in these songs are beautiful and well played. The bass playing on this record, like on all these first three songs, is amazing. And this is one of those things where, like, it was an LP, right? Like, I listened to side one over and over and over and over and over. I didn't flip over to side two for like 3 months when I first bought it. And I also, the Flat Earth just happened to capture the guys I was playing in a band with, right? Like, my high school band and I, we all fell for this record. We all listened to it all through high school. We were constantly putting it on at parties. So our friends got to know it. Like, it's just been, it was a big part of my life. I know this record as well as any record in my collection, every little tiny flip and blur.
That's a bold statement.
Yeah, I do. But I mean, I know this, this is a record that I'm just like weirdly familiar with. So I'm going to play you the first verse and chorus of The Flat Earth. This is actually almost 2 minutes into the track. The track starts really slowly with this kind of ambient bass. There's no sense of where the beat is. And he starts introducing all these weird sounds that become, once the rhythm is established and once he starts singing, these sounds are all counterpoints to the band's performance. So it's again, it's this guy who understands I have this huge tapestry that this technology offers me, and I'm just going to fill it with sounds in and about. This is not a record that you would ever find intentionally, right? This is one of those records where people have to be like, give this record a chance. And you might not be able to get past the 80s and the 70s. But I think of all the keyboard records of the 80s, of all the like records you could put on where you're like, well, that's mid 80s. This is the one that transcends its the sound of its moment and is, as Ben said last week about Let's Dance, this is capital A art. Here's a minute of Thomas Dolby's The Flat Earth.
The Flat Earth by Thomas Dolby.
He's playing everything. All those sounds are his.
I think there's a guitar player that helps him out with that kind of South African Graceland thing, which, by the way, predates Paul Simon's Graceland by a year. But I just love, like, he's a killer singer. These are on all those sounds, like that boom, like, it's all in time. Once you listen to the song three or four times, it works as a part. It's not just like, it sounds like noise the first time, then you realize he's got it in the groove. It's a really challenging record. There's a song in 10-8 on side two where the only percussion is the sound of crickets. I mean, it's an art record. But I really respect that this guy, rather than try to become like an 80s pop icon, took this moment, ran with it, made the record of his life, and it killed his career. I mean, this record came out, it sold 1/10 of the last one. The record company cut his promotional budget in half for the third record. And he just walked away. He was like, well, screw it then. And he became a producer and he became an engineer.
Where is he now?
Well, funnily enough, he's in Baltimore, Maryland these days, or he was for a while. My friend Mike was in a poker game with him a couple of times, but he continues to make music every once in a while. He does solo shows now where he does all these songs and he's programmed all the stuff and he's playing live and he's got all these things going on behind him. I saw Thomas Dolby live at the 930 Club in 1988. He had a full 8-piece live band and he did all the best songs from his first three records without any backing tracks, without any tapes. They were unbelievably great. And it was like a club that hold like 300 people. They just tore the roof down. But it just, you know, this record pushed him into the fringes of pop culture. But this record endures in ways that most stuff from the 80s don't. I love this record. I recommend it unreservedly. And awesome. It's my total left field bizarro pick for 1984.
Awesome. And I'm just going to keep cutting Ben's mic so he doesn't weigh in at all.
No, no, go, buddy, go. I'm set. I've teed him up. Everything Ben hates about the 80s is embodied by this guy, and I still think this record's fantastic. So I will mute myself.
He should turn off his sound. Oh, wait, he really is muted.
He really is. Muted.
Oh, no, I did not mute myself. Anyhow, I thought it was going to be a Minutemen thing, right? But yeah, I guess you chose them last time, and that would not have pleased India. This at least is like more melodic, so that'll please her. I just can't. In this one, bless Jeff's heart. I gave it a try.
Did you?
I listened to this, but I did not listen through to the cricket song. But that there were crickets for me after the first song. It's like, oh, this is not working out for me at all. And this will hurt Jeff's feelings, but I'm with the freaking record company. When he turns this album in, they're like, it's not She Blinded Me the Geography. Like, hello, McFly, wake up. Like, we asked you to do one thing. It's not hard. Like, how many more of those could he have put out?
She blinded me to taxonomy.
I know. There's a lot of things that are blinding. You know what I mean?
He could have been the Weird Al Yankovic of the 80s in some way, like just parodying himself. And like, you're totally right. But yeah.
I can't get over any of those sounds. I don't like those sounds.
Do you, is this in David Gray's neighborhood? Like, British guy working on sounds by himself? Putting out the album he wants?
Because
Ben couldn't stand that either.
No, that one at least was the genre I like. Keyboard, I mean, believe me, 6-minute art keyboard record. I'm like, hey, wow.
Yeah, not okay. A thing.
All of these things I don't like.
No, I know. It's like, it's almost like I pulled everything out of a blend, like everything Ben hates, and put it in a blender. And it was like, you should drink this.
He said,
I don't have any illusions that I'm winning Ben over, but maybe some of our fair listeners.
Well, who are, I am going to give it a try. I have never listened to the Flat Earth. I would love to have met Thomas Dolby in a poker game. I think that would be hilarious.
Apparently he's not to be trifled with. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, good stuff. Listeners, you can come at us on Twitter about our picks and see what you think of the Flat Earth. Ben Barton, it is over to you.
So I'm going to tell a story of discovery and then loss and then rediscovery. So in 1984, you mentioned, it's my sophomore year in high school. And it's like, remember last year, my favorite album was a Fix album. So my musical taste was a little spotty.
By the way. Like, have you listened to that those records? There's some noises on that shit as well.
For sure. Okay. For sure. Music tastes a little spotty. My musical taste is starting to get better. My taste in movies is starting to get better. Like, it's not, I would be strong to call me like a Brooklyn hipster, but I'm like coming around a little bit. In this year, the movie and the soundtrack Stop Making Sense come out. And I had not been a Talking Heads person. I basically, like, first of all, they came out when I was little. But second, even speaking in tongues, I was like, nah, you know, it's okay. This album and this movie blew my mind how good it was. So the band takes 3 years off before Speaking in Tongues. And they've already put out a live album, which I'm sure Jeff likes. That I just don't care for it. It's a double live album, and it's not their best material. The single album version of Stop Making Sense is the world's greatest hits record. It's so much better than their greatest hits record because it doesn't include any stuff that came after this album. It's fantastic. And the reason why it's fantastic is pretty clear. It's Jonathan Demme is the director, and he's like got a really weird career up until now. He starts out in Harvey Korman. He starts out in the Korman school where he's like creating these, it's just creating these movies one after another, bang, 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 through the 70s, so like these exploitation movies with no budget at all. Then he does two or three art movies, including one that gets some buzz in 1980. And he gets to be buddies with David Byrne and the Talking Heads guys. So he's like, we should do a concert movie, but not a regular concert movie. And they're like, yes, that's what we should do. And he's like, no one will give us money to do this. And they're like, no one has to give us money. We'll front the money for the movie. So they put up $1.5 million of their own money. I think they do, I don't know, it's like four or five straight nights at the Hollywood Bowl, and they let Demi record it. And it's awesome. For a non-commercial band and a super weird and artsy band, they choose an artsy director, but you can tell they don't want to screw up. Like, it's an amazing performance and a beautiful visual performance and just spectacular all the way along. They only choose good songs except for the one Tom Tom Club song, which maybe Jeff likes, but I hated the Tom Tom Club and that song sucks. Other than that, it's every good song they have, period. And I mean, it's like, and I would imagine that if you saw Talking Heads during this period, and the previous live record reflects this, that wasn't what their shows were like. I'm sure they were like, well, we play some weird stuff to annoy you because we're the Talking Heads. But for the movie, they were like, nope, just nothing, one banger after another, and amazing rearranged spectacular versions of it. Comes out in Psycho Killer by himself with a drum machine. The rest of the band slowly joins him on stage. It's just absolutely incredible. I didn't like this record. I love this record. This will be, I guess, I can't remember if I did AC/DC, but this will be the first time that I'm choosing a record from the year where that was my favorite record of that year. I wore this record out. And I'm super sad to report, the very next year, they put out an awful piece of crap I hated, Little Creatures. And it broke my heart to the point where, and I can be a small and vengeful person, where I was like, not only do I not like Little Creatures, I don't like them. Like, I don't even like Stop Making Sense anymore. Little Creatures is this hideous keyboard record that sounds like crap and the songs are bad. And now I'm just out on this band altogether. So that's the loss that I suffered. I just lost this band, period. I go for a long time. I hadn't listened to Stop Making Sense since 1985. I mean, you would hear it at parties or whatever, but sure. I mean, I had completely eliminated it. I never bought the CD. Like, I just had the single record. I'm reading to my daughters. Okay, so first, I think I previously mentioned this. Like, if and when you have children small enough to sit still for you to read, read to them. It's the greatest. I can't recommend it highly enough. Not only is it like an amazing bonding thing for me personally, and I'll be super curious as other teachers if you agree with this, such good professional training. Like, if you're going to do any public speaking at all, read the children. They, especially like a two-year-old, they don't have no politeness at all. Yeah. They're like, you they'll suck at this, I'm out.
They'll let you have it.
Like, they're actively bored right in front of you. You can't do it. Like, so you got to do the, like, you got to get the cadence to it right. You got to get the voices right. Like, if you can't entertain a kid reading Dr. Seuss, do it until you can. Like, it's a skill, and practice helps with the skill. So I freaking loved it. Any chance, and still, like, if I'm visiting with my nieces or nephews or whatever, any kid will stand still in front of me. I'm like, let's get this book out. Let's do this thing. Anyhow.
Can I just add a caveat?
Yeah,
choose
please.
Your Dr. Seuss wisely.
Oh, yeah.
If you're good at it, you will find yourself reading Bartholomew and the Oobleck every night, and that takes almost an hour to get through, and you will fall asleep. Like, three quarters of the way through the book.
Yeah. Oh, I thought you were going to do the Mulberry Street thing, which has got the unfortunate stereotypes.
No. Whatever. But then Scrambled Egg Super is also like a good 47-minute event. Some of those Dr. Seuss, like, he just keeps collecting eggs for like 70 pages.
So we're in the really, really beautiful period where we're transitioning out of picture books and moving into chapter books. And again, I just strongly recommend that period. So fun. My personal favorite one of those was Watership Down. Like, that one just crushed the girls. And I love that book. Oh, fantastic. Angry rabbits attacking each other. Can't do better. but this particular book, and this is funny, I've recommended other people and their mileage will vary. So this may just be a Ben Barton, like, sentimental favorite, but it's Kate DiCamillo's
Mercy
miraculous
Watson?
Journey of Edward Tulane. So okay. Edward Tulane is about a really pretty clay bunny, and he has an owner who loves him, but he doesn't appreciate her, and then he gets sold, and then it takes him on this travel through these various different settings with him, where a lot of bad things happen to him, and he gets broken, and his life kind of gets messed up, and I'm starting to get choked up.
Oh.
It ends where he gets repaired, and then he gets given back through like a thrift shop to his original owner. And like the last page, like, he's learned this lesson, a beautiful lesson about life, and he's gone home. So I'm just sitting there with my daughters, and I'm like just all choked up. I'm actually crying, and they're like, oh, it's so. And first of all, it's just lovely to have daughters. They're so nice to me. They're like, oh, it's so, like, look at this, so cute. Dad's crying. What is it? And just from the deep recesses of my mind, for no reason at all, I just say, home, it's where you wanna be, but I guess I'm already there. And it just broke me. Like, I'm just sobbing because the book is about this story, and that song somehow so perfectly captures this moment where it's like the place you live with the people you love is your home, but it takes a while for you to recognize that. You know what I mean? Like, you sort of have to accept that and understand that. And then when you do, it's just so overwhelming. Went back, re-listened to Stop Making Sense. Couldn't put it down. I love that song. I love the performance of the song. I love the movie.
Stop Making Sense, The Talking Heads.
This will be the place, Naive Melody, right? That's what it's called? That's the action light movement?
Yep.
Stuff.
Jeff, I've got a weird trivia question for you. What are the three best-selling Talking Heads albums in order?
Ooh, I'm going to guess Little Creatures is number one. I'm going to guess that Speaking in Tongues is number two. And I might put this one at number three. But I'm afraid it's True Stories, which will really break my heart.
No, True Stories is like 650,000 copies. And you got it right, but you got the order wrong. Stop Making Sense is the best-selling album.
How about that?
All right.
2.6 million, and then Little Creatures is just behind it at 2.5, and then Speaking in Tongues just behind it at 2.3. And the thing that really, I was really surprised by that, because first I thought that Little Creatures sold like a jillion. Like,
yeah, you would think, God, it was inescapable on the radio for a year. Yeah.
And I also thought, like, I had this story in my head about them selling out and how painful it was for me and what a pain in the ass it was. But it's actually like it's kind of the opposite. It's like they put out this really, really commercial record
that didn't sell.
And it didn't outsell their best album. It's just a little bit weird.
That's good.
In that way, for sure.
That is so interesting.
But yeah, no, again, of the various reasons to choose a live album, this hits all of the sweet spots. It's every good song they ever wrote, period. It's amazing versions of every good song they ever wrote, period, including like reorganized, rearranged, super interesting takes on it. And the way they put it, like the actual set list, when you watch the whole movie, it's like, it's weirdly powerful how they layer it. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like a typical concert where it's just like they play a great song at the beginning, a couple of songs in the middle, and then a couple of great songs at the end. Like, it's thematic all the way through it. And then the music, and then the filming of it, like everything about it just comes together into this amazing artistic statement.
Yeah, it's great.
Totally agree. I do love that other live record, especially the second disc, which has, of course, the Adrian Belew version of Talking Heads, which I talked into the ground the last time we did this exercise. This is a great band. Here's a trivia question. The three background singers on in the Stop Making Sense band graduated to this tour from what other gigantic tour that ended in 1984?
You're the best man. Tell us. I love this.
They were the backing singers that went on tour with the Police on the Synchronicity tour. Dolette McDonald and her friends. Same set of singers.
Oh, that's fascinating.
I saw this movie with a young Ben Barton. Do you remember when we went and saw this together?
I do not. We saw we it went at the Retro House?
At the Tiburon Art House Theater. They were doing a one night only. And we went and saw it. And they had an original 16 millimeter print. And they turned it up incredibly loud. It was so great. It's the only time I've ever seen it on the big screen.
Yeah, that's awesome.
The only other movie we saw at that theater together was Bad Lieutenant.
Oh, I remember that one well, too.
Where when we bought the tickets, the guy was like, just so I'm clear, there's no refunds. We were like, what? He's like, if you walk out after 5 minutes and ask for your money back, I can't give it to you. And I remember returning to you. I'm like, this is such a sign that we are throwing our money away. And you're like, no, Harvey Keitel, it'll be good. It'll be good.
No, I thought it was great. We left. Jeff was disgusted. It's a disgusting, super ultraviolet movie. And I was like, what are you talking about? The name is Bad Lieutenant. Was he good?
told us exactly what it was.
It really was the best named movie of that year. If it had been called Really Bad Naked, you know, Nun Raping Lieutenant, then we really would have had all the information we needed in the title.
So I love it.
I love this record. I love this band. Talking Heads is, you know, Talking Heads studio records frequently make the top 4 or 5 list of 80s records. But Ben is 100% right. Like this band's 2 live records are its best 2 records. I prefer the name of this band is Talking Heads and Stop Making Sense to everything else in their catalog. And it's not even close. What a great live band. And what a shame that they cannot get along and get back together and play these songs live again. It's such a bummer. If there's any 80s band that I would pay a lot of money to see do this all again live, it would be these guys. It'd be really fun.
That song Home, I remember Jeff Simons. It became my favorite Talking Heads song because of your rock and roll class. Because when I was visiting you one time, I went, and I believe it was a young Matt Jaffe.
It was a young Matt playing, Jaffe singing this song.
Playing that song in your class up on the upper campus there. And I was like, oh, this is a great song. And who is this kid? This kid, he's going places. That's what I said at the time.
He's a Talking Heads fanatic.
Nice job. Matt Jaffe, all right. Well, good work by both of you. Fascinating choices. I did not choose Born in the USA. I did not choose Purple Rain. I did not choose Like a Virgin. And 14-year-old Tim Plain is going to be very disappointed in me that I did not choose the Go-Go's Talk Show.
Which has at least one fantastic song on it. The song Head Over Heels.
It's so good. And Turn to You, I think, is a great song with a young Rob Lowe in the video.
Oh, how about that?
Yeah.
Head Over Heels is a fantastic, fantastic song from Talk Show.
I have aged. And now an album I'm much more likely to put on over the Go-Go's is Sade's Diamond Life.
Oh, Timmy, yes.
I mean, I love Sade. And it's like the older I get, the more I love Sade. And Jeff Simons, if you could just play a little bit for me of, gosh, such a hard call. Let's go with Hang On To Your Love.
Diamond Life by Sade.
Think Sade, where do we fall?
I have two immediate thoughts. Go. My first thought is this is what's playing in every bar James Bond walks into. Like, it's just this sound. Like, this is the sound of like him playing Baccarat, you know what I mean,
in Zanzibar.
whatever that is. My second is Childish Gambino hosted SNL last year and he did a fake 80s music video where he was like breaking up with his girlfriend because she cheated on him. So he shoved all her jewelry up his ass. And this is exactly what the backing track of that skit sounds like. Like, oh yeah, girl, I followed you and all your jewelry is right up my ass. So I had that in my head.
What is wrong with you? That is not.
I prefer, my favorite Sade song is The Sweetest Taboo because it has all that crazy percussion in the background. I just love that song. But there's
I mean, Smooth Operator's on this record too. And yeah. Smooth Operator is like, that's the coast to coast, LA.
Yeah.
The diamond. I can't believe you didn't choose that one.
What about Your Love is King?
That one's a banger too.
Yeah.
This one make, and Jeff may disagree, this one makes me super happy, Timmy. I'm very pleased.
I just don't, you know,
I
what?
Would not I
just
choose don't... this. Like, it's not a strong, it's not a wall to wall banger record. I'll just be frank. I have actually, I like Sade. So I've gone back and listened to it. And there are not nine good songs on this record. That being said, the good songs are amazing. And I'm just going to go ahead and be frank. Just a little something for the ladies out there. Tim Plain is a sexy motherfucker. That's right. I said it. He's slinky. He's slinky. He likes to keep it on the down low with
no
the
question.
Slow beat. He gets in the groove, ladies. You know what I'm saying?
Well, that is all there's no we have time for.
Jeff is a Minutemen.
No.
Literally, his favorite album is by the Minutemen. And he's like, these songs are a minute long and real fast. I'm just going to say, Tim Plain is a sexy motherfucker. He likes, all of these songs are 5 minute long. That's Tim's jam.
50 years of music with 50-year-old white guys.
Ben is so right. There is no record in your record collection that more telegraphs to your loved one what you have in mind than putting Sade on. There's no moment when you put Sade on and you're going to do the dishes or like you need to talk, you need to balance the checkbook. Like, you, if you hear Sade come out of someone's phone, the it is an invitation. It is like, so kids are asleep, so you know, I folded all the laundry. It is unquestionably the signal record in your iPod, all beginning, right, middle, and end.
I'll tell you what, yes, it is 3:30 in the afternoon on a Sunday. I'm gonna go upstairs from the basement and ask Alexa to play Sade, and I'll just start doing the dishes, and we're gonna see what
you
happens.
You better you better have a large pizza to send the kids outside to eat if you're gonna do that, because it is gonna be on like Donkey Kong.
I was so disturbed when you said you better have a large pizza because I wasn't sure what role that would play in your world. All right,
that's
gotta go.
That's what happens post Minutemen in my house. By the way, readers, listeners, friends, Romans, countrymen, if you can hear a really discernible difference between the clip I played from the Flat Earth and the clip we played from This Must Be the Place, besides Ben's decision that the songs are different, then I will acquiesce. But man, did those songs sound eerily similar to me for about 25 seconds. I just want to point out.
There, it is a keyboard heavy thing. That's fair.
Okay. All right.
Wait, hold on.
Oh, what?
What's the name? Stainless by The Game, featuring Anderson .Paak, Timmy.
Okay.
Oh,
the
yeah.
The chorus is 2 a.m. riding along, listening to a Sade song. You're just going to really dig it. And it's got that whole Sade groove. You'll be into it.
All right. It's actually really good. I forgot about that.
All right. That sounds
amazing. I will check it out. Hey, we haven't done homework in a while. So I'm going to give you a quick homework assignment because
Ben and I just have endless free time.
Yeah. Right? Well, there's that, but also Nina's coming after me. So to spice it up, the host is giving you homework. We did guitarist, we did bassist, we did best drummer, we did all that in the first season. We never got to best lyricist. So I want your top three favorite all-time lyricists for our next podcast, 1985. Got
good
it?
That one. That's good.
Yeah, all Billy right. Joel, Neil Diamond, and I'll think about the third one.
The Eagles. All right. I will talk to you later.
That was fun, friends.
Well done.
See you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey, if you're having as much fun as we are, leave us a review on iTunes. Give us a rating on Spotify, iHeartRadio. Wherever you listen to podcasts, give us a shout. And then check us out on Twitter or at our Facebook page, 50 Years of Music with 50-Year-Old White Guys.
Are you a fan of classic cinema or a young person who wants to discover the best films of all time? Do these legendary movies still hold up?
On the Generation Film Podcast, two guys who grew up when movies dominated the culture share a great film with a panel of young movie lovers and see how it plays for today's generation.
We discuss changes in storytelling, styles, representation,
the making of each film, its initial reception, and how its meaning has changed over the years.
Join us as we explore cinema classics across generations on Generation Film.
Electric Acid. Welcome to the Candle Power Hour. Come with us backstage, behind the scenes of show business spanning over four decades and bringing you the experiences that can only be told by the people who were there.
Our guests are from the A-list, the F-list, and everyone in between. Get set for some of the most insane, hilarious, and inspiring stories you will ever hear.
I'm Mercury.
And I'm Diego.
Your host for
the Candle Power Hour.
Electric Acid.